Rest in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
With the New York Times in one hand and the Catechism of the Catholic Church in the other, Al Cresta is ready for conversations of consequence.
America is as divided as it has been in 150 years.
Politics is symptomatic of the culture.
They don't have a personal relationship with Christ.
We've been sacramentalized, but not evangelized.
Why should Washington listen to us when our own house is in disarray?
The church's greatest riches are her people.
Share the contagious joy of being a friend of Christ.
Story after story after story of people who have had inexplicable healings.
Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and taking a closer Catholic look at current events, issues, and ideas. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
That's beautifully said, Al.
Thanks for your voice for liberty.
It's like a homecoming each time on your program.
Clear to me that you've thought these things through at a deep level.
Let's build the church, and then we'll bless the nations.
Well, thanks for joining me today. I'm Al Cresta, and on this solemnity of Saints Peter and Paul, again, two of the, that's the great tag team match in first century Catholicism, right? We're going to talk a little bit about St. Paul in particular later in the program, but I'll come back to that in a minute. I want to first of all thank Bruce and Chris McGregor and Matthew Bunsen, Peter Herbeck, Jerry Usher, who sat in for me last week on such short notice. I got called out to an unexpected family gathering in Delaware on Rehoboth Beach. No, I wasn't suffering, I'll tell you that, but it was very unexpected, and to take advantage of it, I had to move quickly. I ran into some listeners there, too, which was very gratifying. It's so encouraging to be out and actually see you face-to-face. You know, I love my coworkers. I love working with Bryant and Zach and Dan, and but it's another thing to be face-to-face with listeners, because normally, what is it? It's my words to your ear, and, you know, that's not the as rich an exchange as when we're face-to-face in person. One thing that struck me, though, it's worth mentioning, I was surprised by how civilized things were last week. Now, I realize it's a vacation spot. People are relaxed. But it was interesting because I didn't stop following what was going on, you know, in media, social media, and internet, and podcasts, and blogs, all this stuff. I was still aware of that. And it was part of the conversation we had among family members, too. But that world of opinion, that social bubble of opinion, that cocoon, that electronic cocoon that we often mistake for reality, can be very misleading. There is nothing of that kind of chaos there. There are some funny experiences, which I'll share with you. They weren't a result of social chaos and disorder. However, it did occur to me that because we have so much connection with information and opinion, that is the social world many of us live in. And that's a world in which there is much chaos, disorder, fear, paranoia, uncertainty about the future. And faced with that, it is more important than ever to go back to first principles. And for those of us who are united to Christ through faith and baptism, this means remembering that God is God and we're not. In fact, there is, in spite of appearances sometimes, there is a rational mind underlying all the change that surrounds us. It's true that we may not be able to discern God's purposes, but we can affirm his goodness and that he's worthy of trust. And oftentimes we are like soldiers in the fog of war. We're dependent upon following the general's orders because he's perched at a vantage point that we don't share. We cannot see all that's happening. We can only see the immediate conflicts in our face. The general, however, is at work, thinking strategically, also recommending tactics. And so I like to stress that Christian faith is not blind faith, but sometimes it must move blind. It has to move in the dark. And sometimes affirming our faith in God means acknowledging we simply don't know how all this is going to work out. And that's exactly as it must be at times, because our faith is in God, not in our ability to read the tea leaves of our circumstances and see how it all fits together to predict our happy future. Christian faith is not blind faith, but it is a rational faith, and it's reasonable to trust that the God who created us and who wills our good calls for us to remain in relationship with him through these times that appear so difficult to us. Rational faith has to be affirmed in the midst of chaotic and irrational circumstances. Morning prayer, one of the antiphons this morning in morning prayer reads this way. I know the one whom I have trusted, and I am certain that he, the just judge, has power to keep safe what he has entrusted to me until that day. And on this feast, the solemnity of Saints Peter and Paul, I thought that was worth remembering. I know the one whom I have trusted, and I am certain that he, the just judge, has power to keep safe what he has entrusted to me until that day. Today we're going to spend time looking at Slaves in Paradise. It's a remarkable story. Father Christopher Hartley, working with Haitian sugarcane workers in the Dominican Republic from 1997 to 2006. We'll be talking about that. The second hour, we're taking a look at the life of St. Paul. My guest will be renowned New Testament scholar N.T. Wright. But first, let's get to the headlines.
Thank you, Al, and good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Monday, June 29th. It's the Solemnity of Saints Peter and Paul. And today's news is brought to you by Charity Mobile, supporting pro-life and Catholic causes at charitymobile.com. The Supreme Court has struck down a Louisiana law requiring abortion doctors to have admitting privileges at local hospitals. Chief Justice John Roberts joined the court's liberal wing in a 5-4 decision. In the majority opinion, Justice Stephen Breyer wrote the state's law posed substantial obstacles to women's access to abortion without providing significant safety benefits. Breyer also cited a similar case in Texas from 2016, saying the two laws were almost word for word identical. Vice President Mike Pence is delivering a message of faith and freedom. While speaking at the annual Celebrate Freedom yesterday at First Baptist Church in Dallas, Pence said the foundation of America is freedom, and the foundation of freedom is faith. Pence added that from the day President Trump took office, he has protected the freedom of all Americans. Pence encouraged Christians to hold on to their faith and pray for the nation. A Catholic teacher is expressing his devotion to St. Junipero Serra. Theology teacher Christian Clifford expressed his feelings for the founder of California's Spanish missions last week after completing a walk pilgrimage to all of the missions. Clifford told the Catholic news agency it was an opportunity to walk in the shoes of the 18th century friars, like Serra. He called it a chance to grow in virtues relevant to his experience as a teacher. Clifford covered nearly 800 miles to visit each of the 21 missions. And the Golden State Killer is confessing today in Sacramento to the murders he committed throughout his life. Joseph James D'Angelo admitted to the murders of Sherry Domingo and Gregory Sanchez as the victim's family members listened. D'Angelo pleaded guilty to killing Domingo and her boyfriend Sanchez in their home in 1981. With your Ave Maria Radio News, I'm Dan McGraw.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. You know, I saw a documentary called The Price of Sugar, which was absolutely shocking to me because it shows that there's an entire industry emanating from the Dominican Republic, the sugar industry, which relies for much of its labor on human trafficking victims from Haiti. It's stunning. There is now, thank God, a book that tells the story in greater detail. It's called Slaves in Paradise, A Priest Stands Up for Exploited Sugarcane Workers, published by Ignatius. It's written by Jesus Garcia with a foreword by Sean Patrick Cardinal O'Malley from Boston. And it's the story of Father Christopher Hartley, who's been working with Haitian sugarcane workers in the Dominican Republic from 1997 until, at least 2006. The work is detailed in this book, Slaves in Paradise. And Father Hartley joins me right now. Father, it's a great honor and a privilege to talk with you.
The pleasure is mine. The joy is mine.
Well, you arrive in the Dominican Republic, I think it was September of 97?
That's correct.
And what brought you there in the first place?
Well, actually, I had always wanted to do missionary work from my early days in the seminary. This had a very specific turning point when at age 18 I met Mother Teresa of Calcutta, St. Teresa of Calcutta now. Mm-hmm. And from then onwards, I knew that that was the way I was called to live the priesthood, as she would call it, a call within a call. And though I was ordained to the priesthood by St. John Paul II in November of 1982, I was ordained to be a diocesan priest in the Archdiocese of Toledo in Spain, Mother Teresa suggested that I would come to New York to work with the Hispanic population, as I had an English father and Spanish mother and was bilingual, so to serve the Hispanic community, especially the very poor people whom her sisters, the Missionaries of Charity, was serving at that time in the Bronx. So that's how I always wanted to be a missionary, because of the inspiration that she was in my life and the opportunity that I had to follow her to many countries of the world for the following 20 years. Actually, it happens, sad coincidence, that I arrived in the Dominican Republic to begin this part of my missionary life this very same day that she passed away.
I was going to ask you that, because I knew it was late in 97. I remember it very well myself, because I had moved that year to Ann Arbor. So the very day you moved to the Dominican Republic is the day that she passed from this world.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, let me ask you, you're not a lot of people would not think you're a very likely candidate to become a priest, given your aristocratic background. And, I mean, you had lots of worldly opportunities that you could have taken, given the way you're described anyways by your family. What happened? Why become a priest?
You know, when God calls, vocation is a mystery. Yep. I was 15 years old, and I remember it as if it was right now. March 8th, 1974, coming back from school. I never went to a religious school, to a Catholic school. My father was Anglican, actually Protestant, and we're Catholic. I'm the eldest of three. My siblings and myself were Catholic because of my mom.
Mm-hmm.
My father was always incredibly supportive of my vocation from the very day that I mentioned. In fact, he was the first person I told that I want to be a priest. I'm thinking of becoming a priest. And so vocation is something very mysterious. The obvious candidate never gets called. And the person who, it's like that in scripture. I mean, you read the vocation of many of the prophets and the kings, and those whom God chooses are very, very unexpected. And, I've never had a second thought. I've never looked back. I never thought I could have been anything else. I don't think I would have been happy anywhere else doing any other kind of job.
Well, it's an outstanding, again, vocation story. Let's go to the Dominican Republic, though. Did you know that the Haitian laborers were being trafficked into the Dominican Republic when you moved there?
I came to the Dominican Republic, prior to that, my previous assignment was I was the pastor of St. Patrick's Old Cathedral in the lower Manhattan in Little Italy in New York. And I came at the invitation of a priest friend of mine with whom I'd studied in my seminary days in Spain, 20 years back. And he kept inviting me and like the widow in the gospel. And just this, you know, this pain of a friend inviting me, I said, okay, I'm coming to see it. You're going to see that that is not for me. And when I came and I saw a parish that had not had a parish priest for 10 years and that they were desperate for a priest, I mean, I it just pierced my heart. So at that time, the Archbishop of New York, John Cardinal O'Connor, I went to see him. And to my surprise, I was absolutely sure he was going to say no, because he had previously, before St. Patrick's Old Cathedral, he had sent me to do graduate studies in Rome. I did my license and my doctorate, my PhD in theology in Rome at the Pontifical Gregorian University. Going to work in sugarcane fields wasn't, I'm sure, exactly the idea the cardinal had the day he sent me for graduate studies. But that to me showed me the greatness of the man, and he said, you know, when God calls, you have to follow,
regardless
of my plans or anybody else's plans. So off you go. And if it's your place, you stay. And if not, New York is your home, and you come back. but I never came back. And when I saw the living and working conditions of those people, I was absolutely horrified. When I arrived, I didn't even know where sugar came from. I didn't know what human rights were. I didn't know that people didn't know about human rights. I took my human rights for granted, like sure. most of us do when we get up in the morning.
Right.
And I think that when I get a traffic ticket, it's the greatest injustice humanity could do to me. All of a sudden, I realized that there were human beings. They were living literally like animals. It took me like maybe 2 to 3 years to fully grasp the extent of the horror of what my eyes could see, but my mind could not comprehend. I couldn't believe that human beings could be trafficked like animals, that the oxen that yeah. pulled the sugarcane carts had an insurance policy, but the workers, the men, women, and children on those plantations had no access to medical services, didn't have a work contract, were not paid in cash, they were paid in vouchers, that they were herded like animals, surrounded by men on horseback with a rifle so that they would never escape the plantations. And this was at the end of the 20th century.
I know. I was shocked.
And I thought I had stepped into a movie.
Yeah.
I thought I was become an actor in Uncle Tom's Cabin.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
And people kept saying to me, be careful, be careful. They're going to kill you. This is 1 week after I landed from New York City. I said, but who are these people? Who is this family whom everybody just can't even, they hush their voices when they say the name of this family, which was the Vicini family that owns half of the island.
Yeah.
And I realized that terror, the people were absolutely terrified. And I didn't understand that masses of humanity could be frightened. I mean, we've all been frightened on an occasion. So we've all said once in a while, you know, I was petrified. No, there are people who are born petrified
yeah.
and who die petrified.
Right.
Because they are horrified at the fear of what the overseers with a lash, with a whip, with a gun can do to them.
This Vicini family was at one time one of the grandfathers, great-grandfathers, had been in charge of the entire Dominican Republic. They are very, very wealthy. They basically uh-huh. are the powers behind the throne there. And
absolutely.
They traffic in tens of thousands of Haitians. Mm-hmm. Correct me if I'm wrong. Tens of thousands of Haitians remove their identity cards so that these poor people are now illegal.
Absolutely.
And don't have a homeland. We'll come back and continue conversation with Father Christopher Hartley. The story is told in the book Slaves in Paradise. A priest stands up for exploited sugarcane workers. We've just begun here. It's an incredible story. The documentary is called The Price of Sugar. I'm Al Cresta.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popchuk.
How can parents raise faithful kids in a faithless world? A 50-year study of over 3,500 people found that the degree of parental warmth kids experience in religious households was the single biggest factor in determining whether children would become faithful adults. As I summarize in my book, Discovering God Together, The Catholic Guide to Raising Faithful Kids, children are most likely to become faithful adults when they've experienced the faith as the source of the warmth in their homes. The same study found that rates of faith retention in kids skyrocketed when religious dads took point on practices that contributed to a warm, faithful household. Things like generous affection, maintaining strong family rituals, and gentle approaches to discipline. God created parents to give kids a physical sign of his love. The more warmth our kids experience in our presence, the more warmly they'll feel toward the God who loves them through us. I'm Dr. Greg Popchuk, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
What is the great mystery of the Christian faith? It is, of course, the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Even though the resurrection is an historical fact professed by the apostles and signified by the empty tomb, no one knows the exact hour Jesus emerged from the tomb. There were no eyewitnesses to describe the actual moment, only the result, the live appearances of Jesus to his disciples. It is an event that transcends and surpasses history, the Catholic Catechism tells us. The three persons of the Trinity, using their individual characteristics, acted as one in bringing about the resurrection. God the Father raised up the Son. God the Holy Spirit gave life to Jesus' dead humanity and called it to the glorious state of lordship. The Son effects his own resurrection by virtue of his divine power. He predicted the passion and declared that he had the power to lay down his life and take it up again. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
When I was outside of the church, there was always an unsettled feeling. There was always a feeling of something missing and something not complete. The deal clincher is we found our way to our parish, and we met just an incredible pastor. We learned things that we'd never been taught. Wouldn't be the person that I am without the church and without the sacraments, particularly the Eucharist. I can't live without it.
If you've been away from the Catholic Church, visit CatholicsComeHome.org.
Dr. Ray Guarendi.
What is criticism exactly? If you pay close attention, do you notice what most criticism is? Oh, it's not because you're doing something wrong or hurtful, something that needs corrected. Most criticism is, you're not doing it the way I would do it. Or you're not doing it the way I want you to do it. That's what most criticism is. And you have to get good at sorting that out. Otherwise, you're going to get real upset when anyone says anything about what you are doing. Now, of course, you could turn this on yourself. Do you do that? Is most of your criticism a message to someone else that says, you're not doing it the way I would do it? Well, save your criticism for things that are really wrong.
People ask how they can care for older family members who can't fully care for themselves. One answer is Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care. Visiting Angels assists adults nationwide with 600 locations to continue living at home and not have to move into a nursing home. Their caregivers provide assistance in hygiene, meals, and light housework. Services are provided up to 24 hours per day, and you can select your caregiver before service begins. More information, including franchise opportunities, is on the web at visitingangels.com.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. With me is Father Christopher Hartley. His story is told in a book by Jesus Garcia called A Priest Stands Up for Exploited Sugarcane Workers. Actually, the book is called Slaves in Paradise. The subtitle is A Priest Stands Up for Exploited Sugarcane Workers. We're talking about his coming to the Dominican Republic in September of 1997 to find that tens of thousands of Haitian laborers had been basically trafficked, humanly trafficked, from Haiti across the border into the Dominican Republic, where they're stripped of their identity cards. They are then brought to sugarcane plantations and basically held slave there. They can't go outside of the plantation because they're illegals. They don't have any cards. Children are malnourished. Seven people to a room. No water, no infrastructure, no health care. The Haitian workers are under armed guard. They're less than 90 cents a day, and they have vouchers, which they have to use at high price to get high-priced food at the company store. And many Americans, when we think of the Dominican Republic, we think of it as a vacationer's paradise, and yet there's a quarter of a million acres of sugar plantation there. This family, the Bethany family, they own the plantation, and they also own lots of banking activities, property. They own media, and they, I guess, try to stay kind of low profile in out of the media. But their power is everywhere, and they didn't like you.
No, because nobody had ever literally said their name. I'm not speaking of confronting them. That would come much later.
Mm-hmm.
The problem, the mistake that I made, quote unquote, was that I said their name publicly. I had just landed as a foreigner in that country, and nobody told me that I wasn't supposed to say their name.
Yeah.
So at the end of January of the year 2000, the President of the Republic, President Leonel Fernandez, came from some political activity to one of those hamlets called Bateyes, which is the little population, the hamlets of groups of where the Haitians dwell within the sugarcane fields, and for some political activity in his re-election campaign. And I was invited to do this invocation, which basically meant, God bless you, Mr. President, you're the best guy that's ever come to the island. You're going to win the elections. And let's say three Hail Marys. And something hit me, which I'm sure I would never, ever do again. I would certainly never do it today with what I know and what I've lived and suffered. But that was a tribute to my naivete. Mm-hmm. That I wrote a speech, a three-page speech, which I read instead of a prayer. Mm-hmm. And basically it began with the words, Mr. President, whether you realize it or not, you have come to the threshold of hell. Mm. Please allow me to briefly describe what this hell is all about. I mean, we were in these days before the stand, before the sugarcane fields and the local population in front of us. I didn't realize there were so many journalists, TV cameras, etc. But the next morning, front page at every newspaper, priest to president, Mr. President, you have come to the threshold of hell. And I mentioned the name Iccini in my speech. Mm. And that was the first time that their name was published in the press, which I didn't know was absolutely taboo. It was an unspoken rule, law, whatever. But there it was. So this family contacted me and asked to meet with me and the bishop and other priests and the attorney. So we met. This speech happened on the end of January 2000.
But the speech forced them to...
Absolutely, the dialogue.
Yeah, to dialogue with the church.
Yeah.
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 How'd that go?
And it was a great dialogue because they're very polite people, as rich people tend to be, mm-hmm. Because they're well-educated.
Right.
But in 2000, nothing happened. 2001, nothing happened. We kept meeting once a year. 2002, nothing happened. And then I began to think, maybe nothing's going to happen, except that we all became very friendly, good friends.
Right.
And then I realized that the only place I could turn to, and I'm saying this to you and to your listeners, because of the power that you have to do good, was to the media. Mm-hmm. The only reason why things change was because the media gave me the opportunity to let my voice be heard beyond the sugarcane fields. I could be screaming my lungs out in the middle of a sugarcane field and nobody would hear my little voice. But the media changed my life and changed the lives of millions of people, of thousands and thousands of people at least. And that's when the media began to pick up this, and then it went to the press. The Miami Herald published a great article in the Spanish edition, the Financial Times in London, the New York Times, the Boston Globe, and then it was everywhere. And that's when the producers of the documentary, The Price of Sugar, get a wind of this story, and they decide to make this documentary telling this about the plight of the Haitian migrant workers and what was happening to me. And then that's when the confrontation went to its highest level, until I was on Capitol Hill and to testify in 2007. And coming down the steps of Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C., I was served a subpoena by the attorneys of the Iccini family. And that's when it was all out war.
Yeah. I want to continue with that. I do have a question for you first, and that is, you mentioned that the meeting with them, they're very friendly, they're very cultured and skilled, and how can they live knowing that under their employ they have these men and women who are without health care, without, well, except for what the church was able to do, without food, that the children are growing up in dead-end situations. How can they, you have to ask, what's happened to their humanity? I mean, you would expect, even in terms of their own best interest, you would think they'd want a healthier workforce, so they'd give them at least minimal health care. Why do they do what they do?
Your reflection could not be more accurate, because I don't think there's one single intelligent person, especially businessmen, who said, if I were in their position, I would, in the first 5 minutes, meet with a priest, tell me, Father, what's wrong? I'd fix it.
Yeah.
And off we would go.
Yeah. Yeah.
The money that they have spent in attorneys, if they had given me 10% of what they paid their law firm called Patton Boggs, if they had given me 10% of what they paid Patton Boggs, I would have fixed those plantations to pristine quality.
Yeah.
But let me tell you something. You ask a question, a very valid question. You say, how can they live? Well, let me tell you, they are very devout Catholics. Devout Catholics. The nuncio in the Dominican Republic, you know what the nuncio is,
sure.
The representative of the Holy Father.
Yeah.
He's an American. Timothy Broglio, the head of the armed forces today.
Yes, I know
of
him.
All the military archbishop of the armed forces. He was the nuncio, and he was celebrating the funerals of the Vicini and their first communions.
Wow. Wow.
While Father Hartley was screaming his lungs out in the plantation.
So if you had just performed Mass, if you had just, performed the liturgy there and people came to Mass, they probably wouldn't have had any problem with you. But it's when you began applying the gospel to the lives of the people there that you got into trouble.
Absolutely. They kept calling me a communist. But you know, the thing is, I was ordained by Pope John Paul, and Pope John Paul said in the homily of my ordination, words that poor little me would never imagine what they were going to mean 10 years down the line, down the road in my life. He said, one of the things he told us to celebrate Mass and to be holy and to dress in clerical clothes and to love the Virgin Mary. He also said, commit yourselves to all the just causes of the workers.
Yeah.
Not me in Spain on the day of my ordination. What did I know that was going to mean in my life?
Yeah, yeah.
But then suddenly those words I remembered. So this is what the Pope said. John Paul II, a saint, published 3 encyclical letters on social justice. We have all the body of the teaching of the fathers of the church, St. John Chrysostom, St. Basil. You have the Gospels. You have the lives of myriads of saints who stood up in the 5 continents for the cause of the oppressed, for the poor. What did I need to go and borrow ideologies, whether Marxist or any other, when I had the body of doctrine that could not be more clear of what was the responsibility of a pastor? I wasn't a member of an NGO. I didn't work for the United Nations or for any human rights organization. I was a parish priest going about his job.
Yep.
But when I celebrated Mass at 4 p.m. under a mango tree with a portable Mass kit, and I saw all those poor people there, and I said, the Mass has ended, go in peace, I would ask them before the final hymn, what did you eat today? And they said, nothing yet.
Right.
And I could see them that they had been chewing raw sugarcane from the plantations.
Mm.
How could I, their shepherd, they called me father, go back home, eat 3 square meals, and call myself their shepherd? I mean, of course, unfortunately, nobody writes a book about a priest who celebrated Mass and baptized babies. But I went out to those plantations every single afternoon to celebrate Holy Mass for them. I celebrated 6,000 baptisms in less than 10 years.
Wow.
So, I mean, it's not that I spent my life, you know, fighting for work contracts. No, I went about the body and the soul of my parishioners.
Now, in the spring of 2001, you opened a feeding center there. You were given some property, or the church was given some property.
That's correct.
And at the same time, the military shows up trying to throw you out of there. What was that about?
Actually, the Vicini family took it as a great insult. I didn't even realize they would be offended. They took it as an insult that I would be having to feed the sons and daughters of their employees.
Yeah.
But obviously it meant that people were not exactly being able to make ends meet,
right,
and be able to feed their own children. That was one of 4 feeding centers. I was feeding 450 children every single day on around those plantations. But that was because, I mean, the children were starving. Well, and they were working at the age of 4 and up, working on the sugarcane fields, sowing the sugarcane fields. I actually took photographs of children doing that job to the ambassador of the time, the U.S. ambassador of the time, in the Dominican Republic.
What did he do?
And he was shocked. He was horrified. No, he actually, I mean, to his credit, he coordinated a visit. He came to visit the plantations with me, which put him at great odds with the with the Vicini family,
yeah.
with the ambassador from Spain and the ambassador of the European Union.
Well, but that didn't change U.S. policy, trade policy, right?
It certainly highlighted the responsibility of the United States.
Father, hold it there. We've got to take a break. We'll come back and pick it up. I'm Al Cresta.
This program is brought to you in part by the nonprofit St. Paul Street Evangelization. St. John Paul II stated that for the disciple of Christ, evangelization is a duty, an obligation of love, and the Catechism of the Catholic Church states that evangelization is necessary for salvation. So we know we're called, but how do we do it? St. Paul Street Evangelization can help. To learn more, contact us at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Christ is the answer with Father John Ricardo.
John 14. This is Jesus in the upper room with the disciples before he's going out to his sacrifice of himself for our salvation. And Philip says to the Lord, "Show us the Father and we'll be satisfied." Jesus looks at Philip and says, "Philip, have I been with you all this time? Don't you understand? When you see me, you're looking at the Father." In fact, only two people throughout human history have given rise to the question, not who is he, but what is he? The two people are Buddha and Jesus. Buddha's answer was, don't come to me, don't look to me, look to my doctrine, look to what I teach. Jesus' answer was, come to me, all you who are weary and heavy laden, and take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble of heart. Jesus is explicitly claiming to be God.
If you believe in the power of prayer, Ave Maria Radio invites you to look at their website to submit a prayer request at AveMariaRadio.net. Your prayer requests are shared with hundreds at the Dominican Sisters of Mary, Mother of the Eucharist, the Servants of God's Love, the Monastery of the Blessed Sacrament Cloistered Nuns, the Family of Faith Apostolate, and the staff of Ave Maria Radio. Just go to AveMariaRadio.net and click on the Community tab to submit your prayer request today.
The Call, a call from God. Father Mitch Pacwa shares his experience.
I certainly had a bit of opposition. My father wasn't pleased with this at all, and he kept arguing with me. Once when I was 12, he said to me, "What do you want to be a priest for? Why don't you be a doctor? You don't have to be a priest to help people. You can be a doctor and get married, have kids." And I said to him then, "Dad, if I was a doctor and I help people get better, that would be very good. But later on, they're going to die anyway. So if I'm a priest and I hear somebody's confession and they go to heaven, that lasts forever. So that's better." And he didn't know what to say. And he continued to oppose the idea over the next years. Yet that didn't stop me. And even when he said, "I'm going to disinherit you if you become a priest." And on the day of my first Mass, he did. But as I also said to him then, he told me, "Okay, you're out of my will." I said, "Dad, I can't keep it anyway. It doesn't matter. I'm a Jesuit, and we can't keep the money, so it really doesn't affect me. The issue is I'm trying to follow what God, our Lord, is asking of me." And this has been where I have found the greatest joy, that doing what I believe through my own prayer and through reflection and thinking about it and moving from a little boy's idea of what a priest would be like all the way to now in my early 50s, you know, realizing that this is exactly what I think is going to please God the most. And that's what I want to do, to please God.
For information on the priesthood or religious life, log on to www.ewtn.com/religious life.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta with Father Christopher Hartley. His story is told, it's a compelling story, in the book Slaves in Paradise, A Priest Stands Up for Exploited Sugarcane Workers. It's also well told in the documentary The Price of Sugar. And Father, again, diocesan priest there in the Dominican Republic, again, saying Mass and conducting liturgy and caring for his people.
feeding 450 children every day in this sugar plantation hamlet. And the owners of the sugar plantation, an incredibly powerful family within the Dominican Republic, are just not responding to these tragic circumstances of the people who they employ and their families. At one point, you start this feeding center. The military tries to drive you out. Why did they not drive you out, since they had the weapons?
Well, one of the things I learned was the importance of the law. I had always, as I said before, taken my rights for granted. So I very rapidly read a lot about the law in the Dominican Republic, read the Dominican Constitution, mm-hmm. and tried, and as much as I possibly could, with the help of an outstanding attorney who was actually born in one of these plantations, Dr. Noemi Mendez, to help the workers understand more about their rights and both human and labor rights. The reason why I was not evicted is because I had a piece of paper, I had a document that said that land had been given to the church. They were just trying to evict me, but just by brute force, when the rule of law was on my side. But also I had the backing of the community. Everybody came out en masse to stand before the military and to support me. And then the military just gave up. I mean, they had no argument except the power of a rifle to physically remove me from that piece of property, and they never came back.
Mm. You have the support of your bishop through all this, is that right?
That's correct.
That's good to know. Because he saw this as the work of the church. He didn't just see it as your personal...
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, very good. The world media begin to take note. Your life is threatened here. I think people need to realize that in spite of all the good that you were doing, the more good you did, there was a growing hostility to your work on the part of many of the citizens there in the Dominican Republic. And the Dini family was working to paint a picture of you as you were. They said you were bringing Haitians into the Dominican Republic. Did you ever bring a Haitian
correct.
Into the Dominican Republic?
Not at all. Never. Not at all. I am very respectful of the law, and I have no interest in Haitians coming to the Dominican Republic. The Vicini family are the only ones who actually need them
right.
for their financial interest. Why would I want to bring anybody? My only point was, if you bring them, treat them like human beings.
Sure.
That was it.
And at one point, your life, how long were you under threat? How many times was your life threatened? Did you have to live with that?
I was under constant threat, permanent threat, for the last, I'd say, 2 years, 2004 through 2006.
Wow.
For those 2 years, the government demanded that I be always 24 hours a day accompanied by a policeman or a soldier with a rifle, 24 hours a day. Even to go to the sacristy to say mass, the man had to come accompany me. If I drove out into the plantations, he had to be in the car with me. My house was being stoned at night. I had anonymous death threats, letters under the door, phone calls. My telephone was tapped by the security forces to try to discover who was doing all of this. This was constant, permanent harassment in the Dominican media, which all belonged to these families, to these three families.
So you were not able to rely upon the local media there to actually tell your story honestly.
No, not at all. It was really the international media that saved the day.
Interesting. Why were the citizens of the Dominican Republic, why did they see you as such an enemy? I mean, you were working there on the plantations serving these Haitians. How were you a threat to them?
Well, what the Vicini family did, which was very intelligent, was play the nationalistic card. Mm-hmm. There's always been this anti-Haitian sentiment in the Dominican Republic, by which the hypocrisy is we bring them, they do all the dirty jobs, and they work in construction, sugarcane fields, mm-hmm. but we want nothing to do with them. There is a long history of enmity between the two countries. The Dominican Republic actually became independent, not from Spain. Their independence is celebrated from Haiti, that had invaded the Dominican Republic for 22 years. So they played the nationalistic card that Father Hartley wanted to nationalize, wanted to unite the two countries, wanted us to become all these Haitians have Dominican nationality, and just. They're playing the nationalistic card in a very low, very cheap way, just manipulating people and exalting their patriotic sentiments, and paying people. I mean, the people who were shouting outside the front door of my house were all receiving 300 pesos per day.
So they hired protesters and threatened. Yeah. Oh, mercy!
Oh, surely.
And they had the documentary points out there's a talk show host there, a television talk show host, a woman.
Absolutely, she's a raving lunatic. Yeah, absolutely.
I was going to say, not a very lovely person.
No, not at all. Sure.
So, what led to your leaving in 2006?
The church couldn't take the pressure any longer, and that I had become what was the foreign minister of the time, Carlos Morales Troncoso, the Secretary of State in the U.S., wrote a letter to my bishop in Spain, saying that he had to silence me, and that I had to leave the country because I had become, as they say in Spanish, un problema de Estado, a state problem. That this was affecting the national interests of the Dominican Republic, that I was affecting international investment, that when people were hearing at the international scene the abuse of human rights in the Dominican Republic, there were actually very prominent multinationals who refused to do business with the Dominican Republic.
Sure.
Now, when you touch the financial interests of a family, such a powerful family, not to mention the financial interests of a whole country, then you know that you have a problem. And they had to get rid of me come what may.
So rather than give the workers even minimal decent standards of food, clothing, shelter, contract, rather than do that, they would drive you out. And I just don't. It really, it's a tragic circumstance. Who is there? Anyone who took your place?
Unfortunately, not the way I was carrying out my ministry on those plantations. But the truth is, the story didn't end the day I left the Dominican Republic.
Okay.
I kept fighting at a very international scale. Just to give you an example, in 2013, that's a few years after 2006, I filed a formal complaint that you can look up in what's called the Federal Registrar, which, as you know, is where all official documents of the U.S. government are published. And I filed a public complaint with the United States Department of Labor on account of the trade agreement called CAFTA-DR, which basically is an agreement between the United States and Central American countries and Caribbean, like the Dominican Republic, that can import and export products free of taxes. So the Dominican Republic, being the largest exporter of sugar in the world into the United States, 200,000 metric tons of sugar, I realized that in Chapter 16 of the CAFTA-DR agreement, it says under what working and labor conditions and human rights conditions these products can be imported and exported. And so I filed this complaint, and interestingly, the United States Department of Labor studied my complaint and agreed, after a trip down to the DR in April of 2012, that there was merit to my complaint. So in September of 2013, they published their report in which not only they agree in all the things that I point out that are human rights and labor rights abuses, they actually discovered things beyond my scope and my understanding of the word violations. So at this moment, as we speak, the United States Department of Labor is doing an ongoing investigation, meeting all this on account of my filing this complaint, with meeting with the Dominican government, meeting with the foreign ministry, the labor ministry in the Dominican Republic. So this is all mounting pressure on this industry. And then, if I may add very quickly, there is the World Trade Organization for sugarcane producers and buyers is called Bonsucro, which is very easy to Google, based in London. Now, they accredit which sugar companies, buyers and sellers, could be Coca-Cola or could be the Bicinis, are buying sugar that has been produced according to the standards of the organization. Well, in 2010, the Vicini, the Fanjul, and the Campoyo family, the three families engaged in this industry in the Dominican Republic, were expelled from Bonsucro.
Really?
On account. Yeah, absolutely.
Wow.
So the battle. In fact, in a very mysterious way, the fact that I was expelled gave me such freedom of movement to engage in a much more international scale in my fight on behalf of the Haitian migrant workers. That's why many of the changes have taken place well after my departure.
Interesting.
But on account of this pressure.
Mm-hmm. Now, who competes with the Dominican Republic in exporting sugar? Because most of our sugar comes from the Dominican Republic now. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
Is there another nation that produces sugar?
Yes, absolutely. Mexico and Brazil, for example.
So,
not to the tune of the Dominican Republic.
Yeah, but I mean, we have a preferential trade deal with the Dominican Republic. We don't
exactly
that can be changed, right?
It could, absolutely.
Okay, Father, I hope we can talk again. This is an incredible story, and I thank you at so many different levels for being with me today and for your work. I hope we can talk again.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. God bless you.
Father Christopher Hartley, now we'll have follow-up information so you can pursue this. The book is called Slaves in Paradise.
I'm Dr. Stan Williams, and this is the logic of Catholicism. Solanus Casey said, appreciation is as necessary for social order and harmony as are the laws of gravity for the physical world. Did you know that scientific progress owes a debt to Catholic thinking? The crux of scientific discovery is the scientific method, whereby hypotheses are formulated by understanding the order of the universe. If the universe was not ordered but random, as many atheists claim, no logical hypothesis could be derived and no valid experiment could be devised to test the hypothesis. Thus, the Catholic view of a rule-driven universe allows scientific discovery. Today, tell a friend that you appreciate how Catholic thinking has empowered centuries of scientific discovery to improve our lives. And that's the logic of Catholicism. Explore more at AveMariaRadio.net. Under resources, look for me, Dr. Stan Williams.
Dr. Ray Guarendi.
If I disciplined consistently, I'd be disciplining constantly. If I were consistent in my discipline, that would mean I would discipline more, and I'd be disciplining him often. The exact opposite is the case. More consistent discipline leads to less constant discipline. Why? Because you're predictable. The child knows if he does A, you'll do B. That is why, when you are predictable in your authority, you will actually have to use that authority less. Consistent discipline leads to less constant discipline. The more you act when you need to act, the less you will have to act in the future with similar misbehavior.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. What a story, huh? We were talking earlier, before we began the interview with Father Hartley, talking about affirming faith in a dark world, it doesn't mean your faith is blind. It means it has to be a rational faith that moves in a dark situation. And you can see all over the globe, you have situations of injustice that require people acting faithfully and, you know, given their particular callings. But something I've noticed as time has gone on, as I've gotten a little bit older, and that it may be that nothing that's worth doing can actually be fully achieved in our lifetimes. And that's why the virtue of hope is so important. I think of Abraham, who did not see all that he was promised in his lifetime. But we also know the large story, the macro story, that we have in the scriptures. And, of course, he is now called the father of our faith. So it might be that nothing that is truly worth doing can be achieved in our lifetime. That's a spur to live in hope and to also think as big as God is big, I guess. He wants what's right. He wants what's just. He wants love to be the governing principle, first of all, among his own people, right? Those who are baptized into Christ Jesus. But really, throughout all humanity. I guess nothing which is true or beautiful or good makes complete sense at any immediate moment of history, because everything is subject to change. So you achieve, you know, something here, you may get some justice for people in the Dominican Republic, only to find out that the sugar market shifts to another nation where you have similar problems. But again, nothing which is true or beautiful or good makes complete sense in any immediate moment in history, because in this world, things are subject to change. Faith, however,
this hour
persists.
Cresta in the Afternoon is co-produced by Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
With the New York Times in one hand and the Catechism of the Catholic Church in the other, Al Cresta is ready for conversations of consequence.
America is as divided as it has been in 150 years.
Politics is symptomatic of the culture.
They don't have a personal relationship with Christ.
We've been sacramentalized, but not evangelized.
Why should Washington listen to us when our own house is in disarray?
The church's greatest riches are her people.
Share the contagious joy of being a friend of Christ.
Story after story after story of people who have had inexplicable healings.
Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and taking a closer Catholic look at current events, issues, and ideas. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
That's beautifully said, Al.
Thanks for your voice for liberty.
It's like a homecoming each time on your program.
Clear to me that you thought these things through at a deep level.
Let's build the church, and then we'll bless the nations.
Well, good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. Thanks for joining me on this solemnity of Saints Peter and Paul. Again, I like to talk about an early tag team wrestling match in the first century. Out of their conflict came great creative Catholic thought. And I love both of these apostles because they are so human. We get the picture of Peter primarily from the Gospels, Acts, and then two letters. Paul, on the other hand, we get from the book of Acts and, of course, a wide body of material, his own letters. And as you spend time reading those letters, you realize these are not abstract philosophical or theological essays. These are personal letters to, in some cases, individuals, but mostly to communities of early Christians. So it's clear that when he's writing letters, he's not necessarily thinking of Christians 2,000 years removed. He's addressing particular audiences. And so, you know, you look at Colossians, you look at Galatians, and it's clear that those letters are being written because false teaching has infiltrated the churches. If you look at 1 and 2 Corinthians, you see that St. Paul's writing to address various problems. There are problems with unity, problems with liturgy, problems with sacrament, problem with morality. And the letters are created to speak to readers in their everyday life. But again, most of us don't spend a whole lot of time trying to think of what St. Paul's everyday life was like. So this hour, we're going to go back to an interview I did with the renowned New Testament scholar N.T. Wright, former Anglican bishop. I think he was the Bishop of Durham. He is really at the top of the list of believing New Testament scholars. We're going to get a good look at who St. Paul was. So stay with me. But first, the news.
Thank you, Al, and good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Monday, June 29th. It's the Solemnity of Saints Peter and Paul. And today's news is brought to you by Charity Mobile, supporting pro-life and Catholic causes at CharityMobile.com. The Supreme Court has struck down a Louisiana law requiring abortion doctors to have admitting privileges at local hospitals. Chief Justice John Roberts joined the court's liberal wing in a 5-4 decision. In the majority opinion, Justice Stephen Breyer wrote the state's law posed substantial obstacles to women's access to abortion without providing significant safety benefits. Breyer also cited a similar case in Texas from 2016, saying the two laws were almost word-for-word identical. Vice President Mike Pence is delivering a message of faith and freedom. While speaking at the annual Celebrate Freedom yesterday at First Baptist Church in Dallas, Pence said the foundation of America is freedom, and the foundation of freedom is faith. Pence added that from the day President Trump took office, he has protected the freedom of all Americans. Pence encouraged Christians to hold on to their faith and pray for the nation. A Catholic teacher is expressing his devotion to St. Junipero Serra. Theology teacher Christian Clifford expressed his feelings for the founder of California's Spanish missions last week after completing a walk pilgrimage to all of the missions. Clifford told the Catholic News Agency it was an opportunity to walk in the shoes of the 18th century friars like Serra. He called it a chance to grow in virtues relevant to his experience as a teacher. Clifford covered nearly 800 miles to visit each of the 21 missions. And the Golden State Killer is confessing today in Sacramento to the murders he committed throughout his life. Joseph James D'Angelo admitted to the murders of Sherry Domingo and Gregory Sanchez as the victim's family members listened. D'Angelo pleaded guilty to killing Domingo and her boyfriend Sanchez in their home in 1981. With your Ave Maria Radio News, I'm Dan McGraw.
And a good afternoon to you. I'm Al Cresta. It's always bothered me a bit that St. Paul is not, certainly within the church, we know his significance. But his life would make, seems to me, would make, would be fascinating to anybody looking at the ancient world. It's a life that's full of travel, conflict. He's a man of extraordinary range of emotion, somebody who could was a great community builder and yet wasn't without his own personal conflicts. He's brilliant. And but somehow he doesn't ever seem to gain the level of appreciation that other ancient figures have, Aristotle, for instance, or Cicero. But St. Paul is the man who most of us, especially if we come from an evangelical tradition, Paul is the, in some ways, is the one who introduces us to the Christian faith and to understanding the Christian view of the world. I've read a number of biographies of Paul over the years, but most recently I've been struck by a new contribution by the esteemed New Testament scholar, N.T. Wright. It's Paul, a Biography. And Professor Wright is the former Bishop of Durham in the Church of England, without question one of the leads, world's leading New Testament scholars. He serves as chair of the New Testament and Early Christianity at the University of St. Andrew's School of Divinity. He's the author of, must be close to 30 books now, including The Day the Revolution Began, which we discussed, maybe 2 years ago. But most recently, the book is Paul, a Biography. Professor Wright, it's great to have you back here. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Good to be with you.
Well, this, and I've enjoyed the book tremendously. I've studied Paul for many years, but this has brought me insights in an acquaintance with his personality and character that I hadn't quite seen before. So I hope it's going to get as wide a distribution as it deserves. So thank you very much for
Let's hope so.
Yeah. Let's begin, if you don't mind, with just a question about New Testament studies today. You know the history of the discipline. You're a leader in it. When you look over the history of New Testament discipline, New Testament studies, would you say that the discipline today is sharper, more open to faith than it was 50 years ago?
It's hard to generalize like that.
Sure.
Let me describe what's happened. About 50 years ago, more or less when I was starting as a young student and then scholar, particularly New Testament studies was dominated by German Lutherans. And there were plenty of other people involved, but they were kind of setting the pace. They had the big folk like Bultmann and Casermann and so on, who were these great learned Germans that had come out of the great 19th century tradition and were still carrying that on. And that everyone else was playing catch up to them. And though people in America and Britain and France and Italy and all over the place were pushing back at them in some ways, they still set the agenda. They produced the big dictionaries like the Theological Wordbook of the New Testament edited by Kittel. And everyone was using them and looking at the world through their eyes. Then somewhere about the 1970s, a change happened, which isn't just that the focus changed geographically so that now America produces more biblical scholarship than probably the rest of the world put together, but that with that there's a split between American divinity schools and American departments of religion, with the latter seeing their study as social scientific or purely historical, unquote, and hence not so overtly theological, with divinity schools still producing a lot of theological works, but in their case, often not at all in the Lutheran tradition, but in many other traditions, whether Wesleyan or Anglican or Catholic or whatever, so that the American explosion of scholarship has resulted in a multiple complex world where there's several different discussions going on at the same time about the same texts, often in the same building even, but it's very difficult for a graduate student or anyone to try to get a handle on the totality of what's going on. So that's where we are right now.
Interesting. Okay. That's very helpful. Well, let's begin where you begin with St. Paul, and that is zeal. Your first chapter is titled Zeal, and I thought, this is good. Is this a virtue in Paul's upbringing? Did he idealize zeal, the zealous believer? Who were his heroes? You mentioned Phineas, but tell me a little bit about this whole concept of zeal and how important it is to understand him.
By the time Saul of Tarsus is a young man, the idea of zeal has been glorified in some bits of the Jewish world. The Jewish world is not itself monochrome. There are many different ways of being Jewish in the first century. But Paul's way, the Pharisaic way, is characterized by this zeal, which is a sense that God wants to rescue Israel. God is going to fulfill his ancient promises. God is going to return to Jerusalem in power and glory and set his people free. But if that's going to happen, because the pagans are still very powerful and because a lot of Jews seem quite lackadaisical about it all, zeal means that somebody, e.g. the Pharisees, e.g. young Saul, has got to get his act together, has got to say his prayers fervently, to know his scripture inside out, and particularly to take action to purge Israel from anything that looks like blasphemy or looks like heresy, and to encourage Israel to keep the Torah, the Jewish law, with a whole heart and in all its particulars, so that then, finally, God will do what God is going to do. And so, as Saul of Tarsus looks back, and we know this from the later rabbinic traditions, the traditions of zeal focus on Phineas in the book of Numbers, and they also focus on Elijah in the book of Kings. And in both cases, these are people who did violence in order to stamp out the wickedness that was in Israel. And in both cases, there are promises attached and all sorts of things. And it looks as though Saul of Tarsus was role modeling a bit of Phineas and a bit of Elijah. And it was that combination that set him off on the road to Damascus.
So this zealous action to purify, to purge the surrounding believing community, that was regarded as a hallmark of covenantal faithfulness?
Yeah, pretty much. Regarded within the circles where Saul moved. Now,
yes,
if
okay.
you'd gone to the temple and asked the chief priests, they might have said no. And if you'd gone to Qumran and asked the Essenes, they might have said no. But the Pharisees, yes.
Okay. Now, how does this square with the idea that he was trained by Gamaliel, and Gamaliel doesn't seem to have the same concern in the one passage we have regarding his attitude towards the early Christians? Well, if it's of God, it will succeed. If it's not of God, it won't succeed.
Yeah. Well, as we know, then as now, students often are far more zealous than their teachers. teachers often think they've seen all this hot-headed stuff come and go, and the students say, no, that's not good enough. We've got to do something about this. And you old guys are getting slow. In any case, Gamaliel is, as it were, a moderate Pharisee, a moderate rabbi, and Saul is a hardliner. In that time, right through to the Jewish War, 66 or 70, the Roman-Jewish War, there are two schools of Pharisaic thought, the school of Hillel and the school of Shammai. Hillel is the live and let live man. Shammai is the, no, that's good, not good enough, let's take action man. But those two are in constant dialogue and a kind of friendly debate. As you know, many Jewish teachers to this day will say, if you've got three Jews, you've got four opinions. And we're having a great time rattling it out. And,
right.
and that's part of the Jewish tradition, is to think things through out loud. And so Shammai and Hillel and their followers were doing just that. But, of course, underlying Torah is all the same. And if you're going to study Torah, go to the master, and Gamaliel was a master. But then what you do about it, there is plenty of debate. And I can imagine Saul and his friends sitting up late in the night, thumping the table and saying, no, God wants us to do this. And you know, they're all trying to be loyal Jews. The question is what precisely does that mean at this moment?
Right, right. People have said that St. Paul transformed the uncomplicated spirituality of Jesus into a complicated, polemical religion. What do you say to that kind of approach?
It's wrong at both ends, because Jesus isn't simply inculcating new spirituality. Indeed, that is the byproduct of what Jesus is doing, not the main thing. Jesus isn't saying, hey, I've got a new way to pray, and if you just do that, it'll be fine. I mean, he is saying that, but that's part of the much larger agenda, which is this is the time for God to become king. This is the time for the Isaiah promises to be fulfilled. This is the time for the Psalms all to come true about God taking his power and reigning. This is the time for Daniel 7 to come true, that the Son of Man will be exalted over the monsters. And so Jesus is doing that. And while you're at it, there is this new sense of Jesus almost as a one-man temple movement, that if you want to get close to God, get close to Jesus. You don't have to go to Jerusalem anymore. So there's a confrontation there as well. And then for Saul of Tarsus, he becomes Paul. He believes that in Jesus and through Jesus, Israel's God has become king of the world. But now this has got to be taken to the rest of the world, because in the nature of the case, that's who it's for. But in order to do that, you need to think through what it means. So Jesus achieves this goal of inaugurating God's kingdom. And Paul is the primary first person who goes around the world saying this has happened, and here's how we should think about it and what we should do as a result.
So St. Paul then's preaching ministry isn't just to get people to believe in this Jesus so that they can be saved and go to heaven when they died. There's something else that's going on here.
Absolutely. And indeed, you can search Paul's letters from one end to the other, and you won't find him talking about going to heaven when you die. That is the view of the middle Platonists in the first century. People like Plutarch, they talk about our souls being exiled from heaven and us needing to go back there. Now, of course, Paul believes in the resurrection. He believes that God will look after his people after death and will raise them to new life when he raises all his people to new life. We have turned that in the Western world into this going to heaven theory, which actually doesn't do justice to the richness of either Jesus or Paul. It's a typical Western Platonic deviation, actually. And so what Paul is doing is much more than that. He's saying, yes, you can be rescued. You can be part of the saved people. And yes, you have to believe in Jesus and believe in your, confess Jesus as Lord and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead. That's non-negotiable. But that is not so that you can go to heaven. It's so that you can be part of God's people here and hereafter.
Mm-hmm.
And then the part of God's people here bit is what gives Paul the thing which he talks about in all his letters, which is the need for the followers of Jesus to be united, united in prayer and worship and mission and at the common table. And that unity drives so much of what he does.
We'll come back on the other side of the break and continue focusing on the gospel that Paul preached and this idea of the gospel as the announcement that the crucified and risen Jesus, who died for our sins and rose again, is now enthroned as the true Lord of the world. With me is scholar N.T. Wright. I'm Al Cresta.
The Call, a call from God. Father Vincent Serpa shares his experience.
It began when I was in second grade. I was preparing for my first Holy Communion, and I went to with my mother and father to see The Bells of St. Mary's, the movie with Bing Crosby and Ingrid Bergman. He was the singing pastor, and she was the sister principal of the school. And at one point in the movie, the sister was being transferred out of the school, and it was very painful for her because she thought it was because of her disagreements with the pastor, and it was really because she was ill and didn't know it. There's a scene with her kneeling before the tabernacle in the convent chapel. And I had never seen anybody pray before a tabernacle before. I'd seen them pray before statues. But at this particular time in my life, I was learning about the real presence of the Blessed Sacrament in catechism class, and it made a lot of sense to me. The other thing that moved me was that she was doing the difficult thing because she loved the Lord, and that was very impressive to me. Shortly thereafter, at the catechism class, the sister that had been teaching the boys was transferred away, and I remember when they announced, my eyes filled with tears because I thought that she was doing the difficult thing because she loved the Lord. Again, that just galvanized that whole experience that I had had. And shortly after that, I was at my grandmother's house, and I noticed a picture of St. Martin de Porres, or a statue of him. He was Blessed Martin then, in a Mary Knoll magazine, and under it, it said, Dominican Brother. So I came into the kitchen, and I told my mother, I want to be one of those. Years later, I actually did. I became a Dominican lay brother, and then after further discernment, I decided that what the Lord was really calling me to was to be a priest, because I wanted to celebrate Mass, and that's the priest's principal function. It's what makes him a priest, is to celebrate that sacrifice. And that's what I did.
For information on the priesthood or religious life, log on to www.ewtn.com/religious-life.
If you believe in the power of prayer, Ave Maria Radio invites you to look at their website to submit a prayer request at avemariaradio.net. Your prayer requests are shared with hundreds at the Dominican Sisters of Mary, Mother of the Eucharist, the Servants of God's Love, the Monastery of the Blessed Sacrament Cloistered Nuns, the Family of Faith Apostolate, and the staff of Ave Maria Radio. Just go to avemariaradio.net and click on the Community tab to submit your prayer request today.
Dr. Ray Guarendi.
To vent or not? If I get it off my chest, then I feel better. I've got to vent. Is this so? It's old theory. Somewhat like a catharsis. You've got to purge yourself of these emotions, and Lord help anyone who's standing in the way. It's old theory. It's inaccurate. Venting is generally not good for the hearers, and it's not good for the venter. Venting may be good for dryers. It's not good for people. When we vent, we become more likely to vent. And when we are more likely to vent, we are more likely to hurt and say things we shouldn't say. Careful on the venting. Better to think about what you have to say before you vent.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically own shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria Mutual Funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria Mutual Funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria Mutual Funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. With me, Professor N.T. Wright. He is the author most recently of Paul, a biography. We are taking a look over the life of Saul of Tarsus, becoming Paul, the great apostle, and what the message was. What is the gospel here? Because oftentimes, at least in modern times, it gets reduced to the idea that believe in Jesus and get saved and go to heaven when you die. Paul is Jesus. Begins saying that the time of fulfillment is with us. The promises from Isaiah are being fulfilled. Something is happening in history. Something is yet to happen in history. And with Paul, something is happening now among those who believe. What was that something, Tom?
Well, that something was that in a whole new way, the God of Israel, who is the creator God, had taken back control over the world from the dark powers that had usurped that control. Now, when we think of that, immediately we have a credibility gap because we look out at the world or we look at the television or we read the newspaper and we say, sure doesn't look as though God is in charge of the
right,
world.
Right.
To which part of my answer is study the ancient history and see what the world was like before the gospel and then look through the first 5, 6, 7 centuries and see the difference that Christianity made to the care of the poor, to health care, to education, and to a sense of the single family nature of all the human race, which was something which not a lot of people were talking about, to put it mildly, beforehand. Now, of course, the church has made huge mistakes and has often got things wrong.
Sure.
But the fact remains that Jesus launched a movement, and he did so by what the early Christians saw as the victory of his death, that his death and then his resurrection marked the defeat of the powers of sin and death themselves, which meant that human beings of all sorts, not just Jews but also Gentiles, not just the rich and mighty but the slaves and the poor and the women and so on, everyone could now come to be part of this new movement, which involved a new way of being human. It isn't just that the cosmos has changed, though it has, you know, because people don't rise from the dead, but if somebody has risen from the dead into a whole new sort of physicality, a body which seems to be equally at home on earth and in heaven, then a new sort of reality has been launched, and all people are invited to come and participate in that, both for their own benefit and so that through who they are and what they do, God can make his name and his power and his particularly his love known to all the world.
Could you say that in the death and resurrection of Jesus that the human race has been born anew or recreated? There's a new start here?
Yeah, absolutely. That something new has happened. And it's tricky to say this, because if you simply say that, yeah, now the whole world is a new place and we're all new human beings, then what's the fuss? And actually, it doesn't look like that. So there is something about needing to believe and needing to repent and accept and then becoming a new creation within this. The way I often put it to students is this, that God has said that he is going to put the whole world right at the end. God has decisively launched this project by raising Jesus from the dead, as it were, by putting him right after bearing death himself. And then God puts people right in the present, you and me as we believe, so that we can be part of his putting right project for the world. So that we're kind of caught in the middle of this great historic movement that began with Jesus and will end when Jesus returns and heaven and earth become one.
Given the enormous blessing and benefit that the church has been to the world, that the reality, human reality, is different on this side of the incarnation in so many ways. Why is it that Paul, in particular, gets accused of all kinds of, say, misogyny
or narrowness, a weird kind of tribalism, especially for somebody who preached a universal gospel.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that the problem here is that Paul's letters are short and dense because he's writing in a hurry. He's not a scholar sitting at a desk with all afternoon before him. He's got to get this message out. He's often in prison or he's traveling. And one of the things that he wants to do is not just give people very detailed instructions. He's not writing a sort of 10-volume systematic on ethics.
Right.
He's writing letters which are meant to jolt people into learning how to think Christianly for themselves. He says at one point, I want you to work this out with fear and trembling. In the letter to the Philippians written from prison, he can't possibly say all the things he wants to say about what their life ought to be like, but he gives them the basic framework and then says, now go figure, work it out. Now, that's the first thing to say. The second thing to say is the trouble is, as the church has done this, frequently people in the church in many different countries and moments of history have grasped some bits but not all, and then have allowed their own agendas, whether it be a misogynistic agenda or whatever, to dominate the horizon and forget what Paul was really saying. Mm-hmm. And that's happened, sadly, even in my own church and the other churches of the Reformation, where people think that the main thing about Paul is justification by faith, and the unity of the church is not really significant at all. But in every single letter he writes, particularly Galatians and Romans, where he's talking about justification by faith, the unity of the church matters enormously.
Exactly.
And we've largely forgotten that.
Yeah, it is amazing, isn't it? Because his discussions of justification have much to do with the unity of the church and bringing Jew and Gentile together.
Exactly. And because we are believers together, and because on the cross Jesus defeated all the idolatrous powers that had held the Gentiles captive, there is no reason any longer for the Jews to say, oh, these Gentiles are dirty idolaters, we can't share fellowship with them. The answer is no, God has dealt with those idols, and if these people are in the Messiah, if they are believers in Jesus, then they are your brothers and sisters. And that's the great message of justification by faith.
Let me move to a bit of missionary strategy here. He writes that the Gentiles were, quote, without God in the world. And at the same time, in the incident we have from the book of Acts, where he's on Mars Hill, he seems to be acknowledging that the ancients had some sense of divinity or some sense of a created order. When he says you are without God in the world, that's one way of approaching somebody. When you say that, well, you have aspirations for God, that's something else. Well, how does he put those two together?
I think that's a nice way of posing a problem. The passage you quoted first from Ephesians chapter 2 is part of a string of things he says, one of which is that you are strangers to the covenants of promise and that you are separated from the commonwealth of Israel. And we have to contextualize what he says about being without God in the world within that. In other words, the living God has made his home in the temple in Jerusalem, and that's where he wants or has wanted to be made known, although things have gone horribly wrong and the temple was destroyed and blah, 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 all of that. Nevertheless, that is the God of Israel, and the people of the Gentiles who look down their noses at the Jews and sneer at the Jews and who say that the Jews are atheists because they don't have a statue, an idol, in their central shrine, that's a common ancient pagan view of the Jews, and Paul must have known that. You don't have a God, do you? Because somebody went in there and he saw there was no statue of the God. So Paul is reversing that and saying, actually, it's you lot who are the real atheists. And interestingly, this is a point picked up by Polycarp 100 years later, when Polycarp is on trial for his life. He's the Bishop of Smyrna, and he's on trial, and the procurator who's trying him says, if you just say, away with the atheists, I'll let you off. And the procurator means, away with the Christians, because the Christians come under the same sneer. And Polycarp looks out at the crowds who are watching this, and he says, away with the atheists, pointing at them, because this is the same point, that they are the ones who are the real atheists, because they worship idols. Now, so all of that is part of the polemic between Jews and pagans and then between Christians and pagans. At the same time, it is clear in Paul in various places, actually, as it is throughout the Bible, that God, the living God, the creator God, has not left himself without witness, and that there are people who scratch their heads and say, there must be something going on there, and hence Paul picks up the altar to the unknown God in Athens and says, well, you've acknowledged that there is a God who you don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And both halves of that are significant. There is a God, and you say that, but you say you don't know him. And he says, I'm agreeing with you. You don't know him. Let me tell you about him. So somewhere between those two is this strange truth of all people being made in God's image and yet rebelling and worshipping idols and yet God going on loving them and calling to them.
Stay with me a bit on that, the Mars Hill incident. Who's he talking to there? Who are these? Are they professional philosophers? Luke seems to have a low opinion of them.
Yeah. Well, the thing is that Paul has already been debating with the philosophers, and that happens at the marketplace. If you want to have a philosophical debate in ancient Athens, you hang out in the marketplace. Today it would be in a coffee shop, but it's in whatever the ancient equivalent was of that. But it's because of what he's saying in the marketplace that word gets around, this man is introducing foreign divinities into our town. Now, you introduce foreign divinities, you're in trouble. Everybody knew in Athens that that's one of the charges that had got Socrates killed. And the point about new divinities was, we worship Athena here. We've got our own god or goddess, just like in Ephesus they had Diana or Artemis of the Ephesians. And if you're bringing in new divinities, our local divinities may get cross and bad things may happen. There may be an earthquake or a fire or a famine or something, and it'll be all your fault. And so Paul is then taken to the Areopagus, to Mars Hill, which is not a philosopher's debating society. It's a court, a law court, and it's the highest court in the land, founded, according to legend, by Apollo himself. In Aeschylus's play, The Eumenides, here is Apollo founding the court of the Areopagus. So Paul is actually on trial, and if he loses this case, the best thing that will happen to him is he'll be run out of town. The worst thing that happened to him is that he could be killed. And so this is not a piece of philosophical apologia, although people have often taken it as such.
Yeah.
It's not even in that sense a direct preaching of the gospel, though it ends up as that when he says God has fixed a day on which he will judge the world by a man whom he's appointed, etc., etc.,
right.
And he's raised him from the dead. That's when they laugh. Then half of them think, oh, this guy's crazy. Never mind. He's not going to be a trouble around here. And I think in a sense, that's part of Paul's tactic. So to lay it down that they will realize that actually nobody in their right mind will ever believe this stuff anyway. Although, of course, some do.
Yeah.
Although, of course, some do.
Some do as they leave. Fascinating. So he's actually, at that point, Paul is arguing before a court and arguing for his life.
Exactly. He's on trial and he is arguing the case for the defense, as it were.
Okay. My guest is Professor N.T. Wright. He has written a magnificent biography of Paul. It's simply called Paul, a Biography.
Cresta in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization, Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 80% of the referral check to Ave Maria Radio and Students for Life. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
This program is brought to you in part by Charity Mobile, a proud partner of Ave Maria Radio for over 15 years. Charity Mobile is the pro-life cell phone company and has sent nearly $2 million to thousands of pro-life charities. 4G LTE coverage is available nationwide, and 5% of your monthly plan price goes to your favorite pro-life charity. A video introduction is available at CharityMobile.com. Charity Mobile, everyday living, effortless giving. CharityMobile.com.
The EWTN home video highlight for June is Living the Scriptures with Mother Angelica. These vintage Mother Angelica episodes will profit your soul and cheer your spirit. Each episode demonstrates Mother's insights, wisdom, and humor, which beautifully penetrate her reflections on the Old and New Testaments. Order your DVD set at EWTNRC.com 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, or call 1-800-854-6316.
This is Dr. Stan Williams. Why do Christians believe what they do? Not what, but why? What are the facts, evidences, and reasons for the Christian faith? Nineveh's Crossing has just released a new book titled Basic Christianity, Facts, Evidences, Reasons. It's a religious education course for teens through adults in Christian history, archaeology, and logic. Basic Christianity, available now at AveMariaRadio.net in the bookstore. Look for me, Dr. Stan Williams.
Bishop Robert Barron on the priesthood.
You as a parent apply Galatians 5. Is watch your kids as they move into the religious space, if you want to put it that way. I, you know, made noises about the priesthood on and off when I was a little kid. My parents were never oppressive about it. They never pressed me in that direction. But they would quietly indicate an openness to that, or like, that's a good thing. I remember I still have it upstairs, a Bible that my parents got me for Christmas in 1969. I'm a little kid. And it's, you know, from Mom and Dad to Bob, Christmas 1969. They knew, they sensed I was kind of interested in religious things. So I would say that, don't be pushy, of course, but don't go the other direction. That's, my generation got too much of that, was, back off. Who am I to tell you what to do? You make up your mind. No, I think gently, quietly, affirming that, yeah, that's a good thing you're thinking about, and you should be open to that.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
What makes an act moral or immoral? The Catechism of the Catholic Church lays out specific criteria for us to follow. When he acts deliberately, man is, so to speak, the father of his acts. Acts freely chosen can be morally evaluated as either good or evil. The sources on which the morality of an act are determined are three. 1, the object chosen. 2, the intent of the act. 3, the circumstances surrounding the act. To be moral, the object of the act itself must be good and the intention pure. The circumstances are secondary to the first two criteria. They can increase or diminish the morality of the act. For instance, stealing a candy bar is wrong, but far less evil than robbing a bank. Intent and circumstance, however, cannot change the moral quality of the act itself. The end does not justify the means. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. With me, Professor N.T. Wright, taking a look at the life of Paul. He has published most recently a biography, Paul, and we are looking at the remarkable background of Paul, his circumstances of his preaching. I'm looking here in Acts chapter 16 at this incident that has always fascinated me. I'll just read it briefly, beginning at verse 10 in Acts chapter 16. They were going to a place of prayer and were met by a slave girl who had a spirit by which she predicted the future. She earned a great deal of money for her owners by fortune-telling, and this girl followed Paul and the rest of us, Luke's writing, the rest of us, shouting, "These men are servants of the Most High God who are telling you the way to be saved." She kept this up for many days. Finally, Paul became so troubled that he turned around and said to the spirit, "In the name of Jesus Christ, I command you to come out of her." At that moment, the spirit left her. When the owners of the slave girl realized that their hope of making money was gone, they seized Paul and Silas and dragged them into the marketplace to face the authorities. Now, this is another one of those fascinating encounters between various systems of belief, and in this case, it looks like commerce as well. What's going on there? Who is this slave girl? What is she actually doing?
Well, anyone who's studied the ancient world, or indeed many, many countries in the modern world, will know that there are all sorts of people who do things like fortune-telling, who claim to be, whether you call them mediums or whatever, who have a gift of second sight. The ancient world is full of such people, and the modern world has quite a fair share of them as well. And in this case, Luke, who is a doctor, is quite convinced that this girl is the victim of some kind of demonic possession. Now, they didn't have very good language for that. We don't have very good language for that. But that's a loose term for saying that some alien force seems to be operating through her, and it's an alien force which can, and in this case is, be dealt with and got rid of. But that's not the real nub of the issue. If it was just, oh my goodness, somebody's been healed of a demon possession, in a sense that might be all right, but she makes a lot of money for her owners. So yes, it's a commercial problem, exactly as later in Ephesus, when the silversmiths are grumbling because Paul's preaching means that people aren't buying their silver statuettes of Artemis anymore, thank you very much, and so they're in danger of going out of business. So these guys who own this poor slave girl, they realize that their business has just gone down the tube. And so then, interestingly, they switch. They don't say, Paul has put us out of business. They say, these men are Jews, and they're teaching a way of life which we shouldn't be made to follow. And so Paul there is being accused of being a Jew and therefore undesirable. In other towns, it's sometimes the Jews who take him before the pagan magistrates to say he's teaching heresy which we Jews shouldn't follow. And it goes from town to town, and each time the charge is slightly different. But often there is a commercial or, if you like, a business edge to it, mm-hmm. and there is a sociological edge to it. Our community has always done things one way, and this man is teaching us we should do it a different way. We don't like that. That is upsetting our way of life. And always underneath is a sense that something powerful happens when Paul is talking about Jesus. And we don't like people with this kind of power coming to our town, thank you very much. Who knows mm-hmm. what they'll get up to next? And so it's a complicated thing. And in the middle of it, this girl is saying, these men are telling you the way of salvation.
that's what I was going to go next with it. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, isn't that funny? And you might have thought in some ways that Paul would be delighted and say, yeah, too right, that's what we are doing. But of course, this is not exactly the best advertisement to have some strange slave girl shrieking this out all the time. People are more likely to look the other way and scurry off home. But it's interesting that then, after the earthquake in Philippi, towards the end of the same chapter, the jailer, in panic, comes and says, what must I do to be saved? He's still got the same question on his mind. Mm-hmm. Because, as I said before, if you bring foreign divinities into a city and stop people worshipping the regular gods, bad things may happen. Now, northern Greece is an earthquake zone, as we know, and there's this massive earthquake in Philippi. So the natural assumption is, oh my goodness, something's gone horribly wrong. Maybe it's because of these people, Paul and his friends. Or maybe they're the ones that can tell us how we can escape from whatever bad things are going to happen. So there's a general confusion. And you can see in the pagan mind all sorts of alternatives, A, as to what's going on, and B, as to how to make it better. And in the middle of that, we have Paul quite calmly saying, okay, we're not going that way, we're going this way. Believe in the Lord Jesus and you will be saved. And the jailer and his family are baptized. So it is an extraordinary... I mean, Acts is such a page-turner, but Acts 16 is one of the most dramatic chapters in the whole thing.
It really is. So when the jailer says, what must I do to be saved, he's thinking what? Saved from this... the earthquake, saved from the judgment that might be coming on us?
Probably both of those and plenty other things as well. He's in fear and trembling. It's the middle of the night. He has no idea. This is not a kind of a sophisticated theological statement. And particularly, we have no idea what an ordinary jailer in a northern Greek town would think about post-mortem realities. People are not going around with a picture of heaven and hell in their minds. It's much more likely to be the immediate situation. And for them, they don't make this distinction between the present world and ultimate realities. They kind of intermingle much more readily than they do in our modern Western world, or in our modern Western appreciation of the world, I should say. So that I think, I remember old Bishop Stephen Neal said to me, the right way to translate what the jailer said is, gentlemen, can you please tell me how to get out of this mess? And in other words, bring it right down to here we are. And then Paul says, okay, you want to get out of this mess, I'll offer you something even more than that. Here's how to be saved with a capital S, believe mm-hmm. in the Lord Jesus. And then basically everything's going to be all right. Now, I doubt if everything was all right afterwards. If the jailer became a Christian, it's highly likely he might stand to lose his job. He probably wouldn't lose his life, but he might lose his job. The city authorities mightn't trust him. So who knows what happened thereafter. But when you are grasped by the salvation which is on offer in Jesus, all kinds of other things start to happen in your life, not all of them as pleasant as you might have expected, but that's part of the deal.
That is, and that is something that seemed to be understood, at least by Paul, and that is that in some way his life was open-ended. He was on an adventure. In his call to be an apostle to the Gentiles, this has led him in places that he probably had no expectation that he'd be going when he was a young Pharisee being trained by Gamaliel.
Absolutely. I mean, there is a debate as to whether Jews like Paul did go around bits of the world trying to persuade other people to be Jews. You have the line in Matthew 23 where Jesus says, you cross land and sea to make a single proselyte.
Yeah, that's right.
There may be some Jews who did that. There's actually not much evidence outside the New Testament of Jews doing that, although, of course, there were synagogues or Jewish worship places of one sort or another in most towns and cities in the ancient Mediterranean world, even as far west as Spain, so far as we know, and then further east in Babylonia and Persia and so on. And wherever the Jews were, there were always local people who would respect them and admire them and who might well want to join in, perhaps not as full proselytes, but certainly as God-fearers, as hangers-on to the synagogue. So it's not inconceivable that Saul of Tarsus, as a young man in Tarsus, might think, well, I'll get trained, and then I'll come back to Tarsus, and I'll go wandering around what we now call Turkey, getting more Gentiles in. But actually, I think that's unlikely. I think it's much more likely he would have wanted to go around and stiffen the zealous resolve of synagogue people to keep the Torah as zealously as they could, so that then God would come in and would smash those Gentiles up once and for all.
Let me go to his relationship with the Corinthians, because we get a real look at the range of his emotions. We get a look at the nature of his relationships. What was his relationship like with the Corinthians?
Very variable. I mean, in the first letter, he writes that amazing poem about love, which we call 1 Corinthians 13. So I speak with the tongues of men and angels, but have no charity or love. I'm a sounding gong or a tinkling cymbal and all that. Wonderful, wonderful poem. And I've often said to people, I couldn't put a poem like that in a letter if I knew that the recipients of the letter were likely to throw it back in my teeth and say, well, Paul, we didn't see much of that when you were around. in other words, he must have known that they knew that he loved them and that he'd prayed with them and wept with them and rejoiced with them, and that he was their man. He'd put himself out for them. He'd worked day and night with them, et cetera, et cetera. But then something goes horribly wrong. In the first letter, which is written from Ephesus, I think it's in the middle of Paul's good early period in Ephesus, in his ministry in Ephesus that we get in Acts. All sorts of things go really, really well for him, and the gospel does extremely well, and he is able to heal people and goodness knows what. But then at a certain point, after writing that first letter to Corinth, quite cheerfully, telling them off about this and that, encouraging them about various things and giving precise instructions on various matters, he pays them a visit. And we don't know very much about the visit. All we know is it went horribly wrong.
This is the sad visit?
Yes. And people say it was the one visit, were the two visits. We're not sure. But there is certainly a sad and painful visit. And he arrives, and has been threatening to tell them off good and proper when he comes. And it looks as though some people in the church greet him with the words, we don't like you anymore. We've had other teachers here, and we actually prefer what they're doing. Thanks, but no thanks. You can just go back to Ephesus if that's what you want. And if you feel like coming back again, you might like to get fresh letters of recommendation from your friends in Ephesus so that we know that you're all right again. And that is just incredibly hurtful. That's like a teenage child saying to their parents, if you want to have anything to do with me again, please get your local lawyer to write me a letter telling me that you're okay or something. It's just incredibly rude, apart from anything else. And so this seems to coincide with the time in Ephesus when something really, really bad happens to Paul in 2 Corinthians 1. He talks about that, doesn't say what it was. We just know it was absolutely crushing and devastating for him. So that when he then writes 2 Corinthians, after he gets out of jail in Ephesus, and he's writing 2 Corinthians as he's traveling around northern Greece, wanting to go all the way to Corinth, he's really worried to begin with that they still are thinking like that, and that he's going to have to try to do this very difficult reconciliation, which is going to be really hard. And then to his relief, he meets Titus, who's come back from Corinth, to say, actually, it's all right. They've repented. They love you. They're waiting for you. They're eager to see you. So it's a very, very heart-on-your-sleeve kind of relationship all the way through.
Tom, thank you so much. Great having you here again, and I love your work. And I appreciate you taking
Thank
the time
you very
to be
much.
With me.
Good to talk to you.
Professor N.T. Wright, Paul, a Biography. I'm Al Cresta.
I'm Dr. Stan Williams. Contemplate the universe with me.
You do not know the work of God, who is working in everything.
Every cell of your body contains a helix strand of DNA made from 3 billion molecules. But only 1.5% of those 3 billion are the genes used to produce the proteins that determine your biological traits. Initially, this caused scientists to label the remaining 2.9 billion junk DNA. But today, scientists are discovering it's probably not junk at all, but critical to our lives and the well-being of later generations. But when asked exactly what good are those billions of mysterious molecules, they really have no idea. But God knows, and one day you will too. At AveMariaRadio.net, under Resources, explore the universe with me. I'm Dr. Stan Williams.
Christ is the answer, with Father John Ricardo.
John, chapter 8, verse 51. Jesus is in a discussion with some of the leaders of the Jews. They're talking about Abraham. Abraham lived 1,500 years before the time of Jesus. So in the course of the discussion, Jesus says, "Truly, truly, I say to you, if anyone keeps my word, he will never see death." He says that often in the Gospels. "He who keeps my word or believes in me will never die." To which the Jews say, "Now we know you have a demon." And they say, "Abraham died, as did the prophets. All the patriarchs, the great men and women of the history of Israel. All these people died, and you say, if anyone keeps my word, he will never taste death? Are you greater than our father Abraham, who died? And the prophets, who died?" And Jesus says, "Your father Abraham rejoiced that he was to see my day. He saw it and was glad." To which the Jews say, "You are not yet 50 years old, and you've seen Abraham?" And Jesus answers, "Truly, truly, I say to you, before Abraham was, I am."
Thanks so much for being with me as we celebrate the solemnity of Saints Peter and Paul today, remembering in particular this hour, Saint Paul. You know, all of us have ideas in our head of, well, if the church would only do this, or this priest would do that, or the Pope would do this. Yeah, we've all got ideas. One of my major bugaboos is that we've lost a sense of connectedness with the biblical story. So that when we think of, say, Abraham, our father in the faith, we don't necessarily have any warm feelings for him. We don't know him as another character. We don't think of him as a great-grandfather or something. Same thing with St. Paul. He remains somehow distant because of 2,000 years, and yet he's alive, united with us in Christ today, and he's given us a tremendous body of material. And so I always like to do what I can to keep alive a sense of family, a sense of history, a sense of connectedness with all of these men and women in the past that make the communion of saints so real to us today. Of course, that was one of the reasons I returned to the Catholic Church. It was this doctrine of the communion of saints. It seemed undeniable that death did not separate us from those who had gone before us in faithfulness to Christ. Well, thank you very much for being with me today. And let me point out that as I go off the air, we've got coming up on Catholic Answers Live, Trent Horn, on Catholic moral teaching, wanting to challenge any particular point that you may reject on Catholic moral teaching. Also tonight on Journey Home, John Mark Rodi, I'm going to be talking with Fali Budak, former agnostic. That's coming up. And I'll be with you tomorrow to talk about art history with Liz Lev and why Jesus is presented oftentimes so white. I'll see you then.
Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio, and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. To follow up on any of the guests or information presented on today's program, visit the Cresta Guest Archive at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMaria Radio.net. To listen to this or any other edition of Cresta in the Afternoon, visit the audio archives at AveMariaRadio.net. Or to order a CD of the program, call 734-930-4506 or email orders at avemariaradio.net. That's 734-930-4506 or orders at avemariaradio.net.